They always come out and remind me to move this so they can hear it in the back. I thought I'd get it right this time before we start. Hi, everybody. My name is Jerry Webster. I'm an alcoholic. I'm wearing a suit because I'm trying to be anonymous. Okay. Got my alcoholic tie on, you know. You can bleed on it and nobody notices. A couple things I want to mention before I get started today. Are you new, Richard? Is this okay? There's a lot of different kinds of AA meetings. I don't want you to judge AA based on this meeting. There's a couple of different kinds of formats and all that. And this is just one of the formats that AA has. A lot of what I'll talk about will be my own opinion. And I'll try to clarify that when I say it. A lot of what I talk about will be from the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and the steps in the big book. And I'll try to make sure that you understand what those are. One thing that my sponsor had me do when I first came into the program of AA is he had me go to step meetings every week on a Monday at the San Marco Club when they had it, every week for a solid year. And the reason I'm mentioning that is so that you can kind of qualify what you hear today. And I was trying to figure out how to do the steps, okay? I'm like one of these guys that I always tried to figure something out before I did it. Does that make any sense? Yeah, as soon as I understand how this works, then I'll, you know. It's kind of like if I had a toothache, you know, somebody say, go to the dentist. I say, well, as soon as I complete dental school and I can understand everything that, Jerry, just turn your toothache over to the dentist, you know. Instead of just following the directions, I had to understand how everything worked. I'm also a recovering intellectual. I bragged to my sponsor once when he was telling me not to think. I says, I have degrees, you know. And he said something like a thermometer has degrees, and you know where they stick that sometimes, you know. So anyway, it turned out, I'm sorry, thank you, and I won't do that anymore. It turns out that, you know, in some areas of life, a lot of degrees is an advantage, and I think for me it was a total liability, I don't know for other people, because it got in the way of my willingness to listen to somebody else and my willingness to follow suggestions. And as I mentioned before, I think there's two things. God, I see some new faces here and I get distracted. It's good to see some people I hadn't seen in a while. It's been a while. There's two things that are really outstanding about how this program works for different people. I think there's one characteristic that stands in the way of somebody really being able to get sober and get the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and work the steps. And it's a characteristic of willfulness. Thank you for the information, but I'm going to do it my way. And I had that for a long time. I think I mentioned I slipped and slid around this program for a couple of years. It's not necessary for you to do that. My sponsor didn't have to do that. The other characteristic is the characteristic of willingness. And what happened over that period of 2 years, the willfulness that I had gradually got replaced with willingness. Okay? I think, for example, when I first came around, first of all, I was kind of ticked off at the first AA meeting I went to. I didn't tell my wife I was going, all right? I had wrecked the car the night before, and I called AA again. I said, I don't think I have a problem, but I'm afraid I might be becoming an alcoholic, and I want to catch it in time. And the unspoken part of that was so I can still drink a little on the side, you know? And so they said, well, you know, nobody can tell you whether you're an alcoholic or not, but if alcohol is causing you problems, maybe AA can help. You know, try it on for size. If you don't like it, 90 days, we'll refund your misery. I thought, okay, you know, that sounded fair. Then I had to decide how to dress for an AA meeting. Okay? And I lived in a nice section of Charlotte, and I didn't, you know, how do alcoholics dress? You know, I didn't think they dressed like this, or, you know, so I thought, well, I got my old flannel shirt on with the holes in the elbows and the old jeans, you know, and the tennis shoes are kind of worn out and toes sticking out, and old floppy fishing hat pulled way down over my eyes, and I thought, nobody will know. And then I go to my wife, I had wrecked my car, and I wasn't telling her where I was going. I said, can I borrow the car keys? You know, and she says, no way, you know. And I said, where are you going? And I said, well, I'm going to meet some friends. I didn't want to tell her that I was going to AA because I didn't want her to think I was an alcoholic. Okay. Like she didn't know, you know. I was the last one to figure it out, okay? She knew a long time ago. She said, where are you going? I said, I'm just going to go meet some friends, okay? And she knew it wasn't business the way I was dressed, and the only friends I had were drunks, you know? So you're not taking my car out tonight and wrecking it. You just wrecked yours last night. And I said, No, I'm not going to drink. I promise. I finally convinced her, you know, to let me have the car keys. And then I drove to this meeting. And then these people sat around and they started saying what I was thinking. And they started talking about the things I did. And I got ticked. I said, how'd she figure that? Call these people up and tell them all about me. You know, I mean, I was angry. And I figured out finally, they weren't talking about me. They were talking about them. And you know how it is with alcoholics? We, you know, other people don't understand what we're talking about. But we understand. I mean, I can talk to you, I can say something about alcoholism. You know, alcoholics, most people don't talk to themselves, right? Some people might. A schizophrenic might talk, well, he might argue with himself, right? An alcoholic will argue with himself and lose the argument, okay? I'll never do that again. And his mind is sitting right up here and says, you want to bet? Just you wait and see. And you, before the night's over, out of, you know, I say that to earth people. You know what they say? What is wrong with him? You know, I say that to alcoholics. And they go, yeah, I know. You know, that's a, I did the same thing. But anyway, willfulness. So I came back and they said things like, try 90 meetings in 90 days. And I says, you don't understand how busy I am. Okay. And so I didn't go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And so I drank again. Okay. And then they said something like, you ought to get a big book. And I went, well, you know, I really don't. I mean, I'm just kind of doing a study, okay? And then you ought to read this thing. And so after coming back, I tried 90 meetings in 90. I never made it. Longest I had dry in 2 years of flip-flopping around was 87 days. If that tells you anything about it. Yeah. I don't know if I'm hard-headed and that's why the hair didn't grow up here, or if I just beat it against that brick wall too many times, you know, knock it all off. But then I would get the big book and I'd study that, and they'd say, you ought to get a sponsor. And I said, a sponsor? I don't need somebody to tell me what to do. I mean, I can read the instructions, you know. But gradually, as I kept going back out and what I was doing wasn't working, it finally got to the point, 2 years later, and when they put me in this room with no doorknobs on the inside for decorating a motel room with a flare gun, I don't know why they would do that, that it dawned on me that maybe I ought to kind of take everything I thought I learned and throw it out and start with nothing and listen to those people. And I think that is the point in time where willingness finally overcame willfulness for a while. You know how that is? For a while, to do anything. You know, and 2 weeks later, well, I'm doing pretty good. You know, that type of thing. But fortunately, I had a sponsor who was wouldn't let me get away with it. And this is a very... You know, I never realized how all-pervasive alcohol is in our lives and how much of a part it plays in everything. Yeah, I don't dream about too many things. I dream about mainly two things. One of them is alcohol, and the other one I don't even talk about in public, okay? And more normal people don't do that. You know, they don't have drunk dreams. Anybody ever have a drunk dream? Scared the hell out of me first time it happened. Absolutely scared the hell out of me with a dream about picking up a drink, and I feel guilty the next day, you know? And now when I have a drunk dream, I recognize, because that's not my conscience, me, talking. That's my subconscious, me. See, I don't have any control about what I dream. I only have control about what I do about it. And I don't act on either kind of dreams today. Okay? But fortunately, you know, one will get you drunk, the other gets you arrested. So, but it's kind of like, there's this part of my mind every once in a while that'll come out in a dream, and the subconscious will go back in and say, Jerry, I'm still here. You know, I'm waiting. And it really is. It's still there and it's still waiting. And all I have to do is just kind of lay off what I should be doing for a long enough period of time where it starts to kind of creep back into my behaviors. And then it's kind of scary. So what we talked about step one, which is admitting powerlessness over alcohol, which was a big step for me. And I mention that as being the basis on which the rest of the steps are built. Now, step one by itself, admitting we're powerless over alcohol and our lives have become unmanageable. And the way I describe alcoholism to me, and this is not in the big book, this is my own opinion, is when I drank, sometimes I would do things I didn't mean to do. I'd say things I didn't mean to say. I would hurt the people that I loved the most, and I would get consequences that I didn't mean to get. Okay? And it didn't happen every time I drank, but it happened when I drank. And amazingly enough, it didn't happen for the most part when I didn't drink. Okay? And that was so weaved into my life structure that I couldn't separate that out, understand why I was doing these crazy things. So I was powerless over alcohol. My life was a shambles. It was unmanageable, okay? I could not figure out how to live. I had to throw everything out onto what I thought I learned how to live. Now, probably for millions of years, people who crush grapes had gotten step one, you know? And if that's all the further we get, that's bad news. That means there's nothing else out there. I'm powerless over alcohol. This is the way it's going to be until the end, okay? And maybe I can speed it up. I mean, that's the thinking I had towards the end of my drinking career. But step two gives us a little bit of hope. We came to believe in a power greater than ourselves, that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, okay? And a lot of people relate the insanity to the crazy things we did when we were drinking. Well, yeah, we did crazy things we did when we were drinking. But to me, the real insanity was picking up the first drink of the next series, knowing I was going to do crazy things. Picking up the first drink when I was stark raving sober, or dry anyway, okay? Knowing that something nuts was going to happen down the road. And the third part is made a decision. That's the action part of step three, to turn our will and lives over to the care of God as we understood them. And that higher power that we talked about, for me, I had to kind of, you know, I'm not one of these guys that rushed out and embraced the steps, as you will see. I think the only reason I'm sober today, I believe, is the grace of God. And at first, I couldn't even say God. I would have to attribute it to some other people that helped me out in my life. One of my first higher powers was my sponsor. One of my first higher powers was the group that I went to of Alcoholics Anonymous, because here was a group of people. And here was one person, my sponsor, who was doing something that I certainly couldn't do. They were staying sober, and they were smiling. Okay? That used to get me about you all, too. You know that? I mean, I remember one of the first meetings I went to, this guy was a speaker, and he was talking about, you know, how his dog bit him when he came home. People laugh, you know, and how he lost his car, you know, and he couldn't remember where he parked, and people laugh, and how his wife, and people laugh, you know. And then he talked about getting sober, and getting sober is kind of like playing country western song backwards, you know. You get your wife back, your truck back, your dog back, your job back, you know. And he got all these things back, and people started crying, you know. I thought, man, these people are nuts. They got it all backwards, you know. I mean, they're laughing at the sad parts, and they're crying at the happy, you know. I couldn't figure out what's wrong with y'all. And as I got to be around more often, I began to figure out what's happening. Yeah, you were laughing at the things we did because you didn't have to do them anymore. All of that was behind you. And you know, I was jealous of that because I was still doing that crazy stuff. And I was really jealous that stuff was behind you. I didn't know how you did it. I didn't know how you could get it behind you and look back and say, oh, wasn't I stupid? You know, that type of thing. And I'm not saying you're stupid, okay? I'm thinking of me. I did stupid things, okay? Wasn't I stupid? I can look back on it. It certainly wasn't funny when it occurred, all right? But for some reason, I don't know why, you know, we laugh at the things when we retell them years later. And I think we're kind of, it's almost a relief. I don't have to do it anymore, okay? So the basis is step one. We came to believe there was something bigger than us in step two. We made a decision to turn our will and lives over it in step three. The very next thing to do is follow the instructions, okay? And when I start talking about step four, I am going to talk about following some instructions, okay? I mean, you can do things a couple of different ways, and if you don't follow the instructions, it doesn't work. You ever hear about the story about the farmer who was constipated? No. He went to see the doctor, and he told the doctor, I'm constipated, doctor, I don't know what's wrong. I just, you know, doctor gave him some suppositories. He said, well, take these, and, you know, if you don't feel any better in about 3 days, come back and see me. So, you know, about 3 days later, the farmer called the doctor back. He says, I'm still constipated. He says, well, he says, did you take those suppositories I gave you? He says, hell yeah, but I stuck them up my butt for all the good they did me. So anyway, you know, sometimes if you don't follow the instructions, what you're doing doesn't really work, okay? Excuse me, moving right along, okay? What I love in the third step prayer, is, God, I give myself to you to build with me and do with me as you will. That's willingness again. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Relieve me of the bondage of self. And I repeat that because that is the key, I think, to what we're doing in step four. And, you know, I always felt, and I use this as an excuse. I told you I was dragged kicking and screaming through each one of the steps. I used to tell Ed, I said, you know, I was really okay before I started drinking. You know, if I just stopped drinking, you know, I'm really not that, you know. And because I was trying to figure out an excuse that I didn't have to do these steps, especially step four. And what I would do is I would project. You ever do that? Let's see, if I do step four, if I really do it honest and fearless and thorough, then I got to put this down. And what that means, I'll have to tell somebody about it in step five. Let's see, what's the statute of limitations on that? And then, you know, then I got to do steps in six and seven on. Then I got to put this person on my list in step eight. And then I'll have to make amends on step nine. And I'm thinking, do I want to put this down? And I'm projecting all the way down to step nine. And Ed said, Jerry, what, you know, time out. You know, just do step four. In fact, do step four as if you're the only person that's ever going to see it. Because with your track record, that's probably true. You know? And so it kind of, he's, you know, I'm kind of one of these people that kind of lived in yesterday and tomorrow. You know what that is? You ever hear that ancient Chinese proverb about he who lives with one foot in yesterday and one foot in tomorrow shall fall through his anal cavity today and hang himself? You know, that type of thing. And that's kind of the way I was living, is I was kind of living in yesterday and living in tomorrow, and today would kind of slip right on by me. You know? I was always worried about what I did, and feeling guilty about what I did, and what was going to catch up to me, and what people were thinking, and I was worried about the consequences that were going to happen because of this tomorrow. And today would slip right on by me. I never lived in the present. And so he said, he also had me repeat that Sanskrit proverb. Okay, he had me read it every day. And it's so true. I mean, when you stop to say it slowly, it's so true. Okay, look to this day, for it is life, the very life of life. In its brief course lie all the realities and varieties of his existence, the bliss of growth, the splendor of action, the glory of power. For yesterday is but a dream, and tomorrow is but a vision. But today will make every yesterday a dream of happiness. Today, well lived, will make every yesterday a dream of happiness, and every tomorrow a vision of hope. And see, I couldn't understand that. And what he was trying to get me to do was to live in the present, okay, work in the present. At one point, when I said, you know, I wasn't that bad before I was drinking. You know, if I just quit drinking, I'm sure everything will be okay. Because I was okay before I started drinking. He says, Jerry, he says, the person that you were before you started drinking is the same person that became the alcoholic. If all you do is just put the plug in the jug, you're still the same person that became the alcoholic. Chances are you're going to pick up the drink again if you don't change. And I had to stop and think about that. And as I began going through step four, that really came true because the way he had me do step four. One of the things that, by the way, I want to say this about the action steps. When we get into the action steps, before 1935, a cure or an arresting of this disease of alcoholism was virtually unknown, unheard of. Almost never anybody ever got over it, got sober. And it was so rare, it was called a phenomenon. That it was so rare that that ever happened, it was called a phenomenon, okay? One guy, Dr. Jung, had worked with a fellow who ended up eventually into the Oxford group. A guy named Roland, who he had a lot of money and could go to some of the best psychiatrists in the world. Did I pronounce that right, Jung, Chung? Jung, Jung, okay. I can read it, but I can't pronounce it, you know. Okay. Some think it might be the apple and some think I'm cervically forebrushed. But anyway, Dr. Jung, okay, whatever. This psychiatrist, okay, was treating Roland. And Roland kept going out and drinking again. Finally, he came back to the doctor and he said, can you tell me the truth? You know, what is wrong with me? And the doctor explained to him, okay, yeah, I have degrees, you know. The doctor explained to him that he was trying to recreate. He says, yes, there is a cure. There are some people who have overcome this disease of alcoholism. But what happens is they have a huge displacement of values and beliefs, okay? And I have been trying to cause this kind of a rearrangement, this huge displacement in you. But I have never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. And he told the man that for him, quite frankly, he thought there was new hope unless he got somebody to be a bodyguard for him or to lock him away, that he would eventually die with a wet, or go crazy with a wet brain or die drunk with the DTs. Now, Roland ended up going into the Oxford group. and he got a spiritual experience combined with this knowledge. Okay? Very similar to what happened to Bill Wilson when Bill Wilson had the knowledge from Dr. Silkworth about the physical disease of alcoholism, ended up going into the Oxford group, right? But the thing was, Roland didn't have, why isn't Roland one of the founders of AA? He didn't have a formula. He couldn't pass it on, okay? He did get a guy named Ebby T eventually, and Ebby T got a guy named Bill Wilson. Well, why wasn't Ebby T one of the co-founders of AA? Didn't have a formula, couldn't pass it on. Bill Wilson got with Dr. Bob, okay? And when you, I mean, you know this program is spiritually inspired when you think about this, right? Bill Wilson, you got a stockbroker who lost his fortune, and Dr. Bob, you got a proctologist who's losing his own. Anyway, and the two of them get together, you know, and they formulate this program that millions of people, their lives are saved, their lives are turned around, okay? What happened? They wrote down 12 steps. They wrote the big book. They made it into a formula that was repeatable, that was duplicatable. And it says that. Okay? It says that and how it works when you read that. All right? Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. It also works that thoroughly have we seen people fail rarely follow our path. I mean, before these 12 steps came along, it was a phenomenon. It was virtually unheard of that people would recover or would be able to live and lead happy, joyous, free lives sober, okay, forevermore. And we got a whole room full of them in here today. So it must be working. Okay, it must be working. And what happened is that this is the part of the program now, the action steps that we get into is what we pass on to one another. It scares the living daylights out of me to hear somebody come in new, or even if they've been around for a couple of years, say, well, I don't need to do the steps. Well, that's true, but you don't need to get sober either, you know. I mean, I think it's very, very difficult to lead a happy, sober life, if not impossible. I don't know that it's possible, impossible or not. I knew it was not possible for me. I knew that I did not get into sobriety until I finally became willing to practice these principles and to do these steps. And it took a long time for that to happen. I kind of liken this thing. Anybody ever see the movie Poltergeist? All right. Do you remember in that scene where the lady had gone out into the rainstorm, got scared out of the house, and they were digging this, it was a trench. They were digging a pool, and she slipped down into this pool, right? And there were all these, I mean, it was death and decay and all these skeletons, ghosts grabbing at her. And she was terrified, absolutely terrified, scrambling, trying to get up. And of course it was raining and the sides were all slippery and muddy, and she'd almost get up and slide back down again, you know, could not get out, all right? And finally, she grabbed a hold of something, I think it was a tree trunk or whatever, that was hanging down from the outside and pulled herself up with that. And I saw that. When I saw that movie the first time, I thought, yeah, it's just like AA, with a little twist, okay? Because here I was down in that pit with all this death and all this decay and all the stench of the way I was living, scrambling like hell to try and get out. Slippery slides, you know, slide all the way back down into it. And then somebody comes along and they throw me a rope. AA comes along and they throw me a rope and they say, grab hold of the rope. Okay? And here's the twist. I had two
hefty
bags of garbage, in each one in each hand. And I'd say, I can't grab hold of the rope. I said, why not? Well, I got these two
hefty
bags of garbage in my hands. And I say, let go of the garbage. I can't let go of the garbage. Why not? It's my garbage. Okay? I mean, it sounds insane, but that's exactly what I was doing when I wasn't willing to get into these steps. Holding on to my garbage. Holding on to my garbage. And you know what it's like to try and get sober and not do the steps? It seemed like every time I came out of the fog, I'd see this huge pile of garbage that I had piled up while I was in the fog. And I'd take one look at it and said, oh, I can't handle this. I go back in the fog and pile some more up on it. You know, and then, well, I can't handle this. Come out of the fog and look at it. It's even bigger. You know, go back in the fog and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth for years. And finally, somebody gave me some tools. They say, hey, here's a pitchfork and here's a shovel. When you come out of the fog, how about if you start cleaning up the garbage? Oh, okay. Now, the way they talk about doing, there are some instructions in step four. The key ones are searching and fearless. Searching and fearless. I had learned some willingness by this time, and it was a very difficult journey, but a couple of things, I really believe there was a grace of God that intervened in my life at times that I should have been back out there doing the same thing all over again because of my behaviors. Even when I was trying to stay sober, even when I was going to AA, okay? One of the things I can recall is, after about 2 months of sobriety, I'll tell you how sick some Al-Anons are, my wife came back, okay? I'm 2 months sober, I'm well now. You know, you can come home, honey. Everything's different, you know. And all I did was put the plug in the jug, and it was still the same me, you know. So she came home, and she brought the five kids home. You know, we found a place in Jacksonville. And I'm tooling along, and I hadn't gotten into step four yet. My sponsor was trying to get me into step four, and I said, but wait a minute, you know. Because what would happen when I came home, the kids would kind of disappear and go into the bedroom and close the door. And what did I say? What do we focus on? We don't focus on ourselves. There's something wrong with these kids, you know? I said, and there's something wrong with these kids. I go to my sponsor. I said, there's something wrong with these kids. They go home. They're supposed to love me. I'm sober now. What's wrong with these kids? He said, Jerry, don't worry about the kids. Leave the kids alone, okay? They're not the problem. You work on you. Get into the steps, all right? And I said, well, listen, I really need to talk to a professional about this. So we found a child psychologist in Orange Park, you know? And I said, Ann, we got to take these kids over there. Something wrong with them, you know? And we took, this guy was very incompetent. We took the kids over to this child psychologist over in Orange Park. Very incompetent, I thought, very incompetent. Yeah, you know what he did, you know? He sent the kids home and he kept me and the wife, okay? You know, once he got a little bit of our history, he says, there's nothing wrong with the kids. I mean, they're acting normal considering what they've been through, okay? I'd stay away from you too. Okay? You need to work on you. Leave the kids alone. Well, I'm getting the same message now from a couple of different people, and finally I decided, well, maybe I better listen, and maybe they'll start working on me. I mean, it's a wonder I didn't relapse to when I was fighting this stuff off. And they start talking about doing certain things. Searching and fearless. Searching and fearless. Oh, that was tough. Oh, that was tough. Ed had me do one thing. He says, Jerry, to start this thing off, he says, the first thing I want you to write down, it talks about, in the big book, it talks about resentments, okay? List your resentments. How much paper do I got? You know, list your resentments, all right? List your fears. And then it talks about sex, okay? And then I need some more paper, okay? But it starts talking about listing all these things, all right? But Ed said, and I still do this to people, I says, what about what you feel guilt about? And what about your secret? You know, and I think Ed knew that there was probably something, the last thing I would want anybody in the world to know about me. And he says, what you ought to do, Jerry, is you ought to start with the last thing that you want anybody, the one thing that you were going to take with you to your grave. Write that down. And when you get that down, the rest ought to be easy. Okay. He also told me to go back over my whole life. And I said, well, why? I didn't drink my whole life. He says, trust me, just do this. And, you know, in doing that, I began to find out a lot about Jerry that was there before the alcohol came into the picture. Okay? I don't know if this makes sense to you. I was an alcoholic waiting to happen. I had all the characteristics long before alcohol came into the picture. I'll just illustrate one little thing here to kind of point out. I went back. He says, pick out points in your life that were significant that you remember for one reason or another. You know, and it was a point in time where we moved from Detroit out to Howell, Michigan, and out in the country, and I was a new kid on the block again, and that kind of stuck in my mind. And then there was something that happened shortly after that I remembered as far as remembering these important points in my life. And one was, we got a pony, okay? I was a kid, like in fourth grade, and we got a pony. That is a big deal. But it was my responsibility to feed the pony. But we didn't have a barn to hold the pony in. So, all right? And in the wintertime, it gets dark early in Michigan. And I always tried to make sure, man, I got to that barn because there's no electricity in there way before it was dark. And one night I came home and I had postponed it. And sure enough, my mother said, my father wasn't home yet. She says, you know, you better feed that pony before your father gets home. Well, I was more afraid of my father than I was of the dark. You know, we lived in the country. We had a woodshed. It was not for storing wood. I don't know if that explains anything. But anyway. I was more afraid of him than I was of the dark. So I got over there, man. I threw open that barn door, and I was slinging oats, and I was slinging hay, and I was slinging water all over the place. I couldn't get out of there fast enough. And it was not quite dark yet, and the snow was on the ground, so it kind of lit up the outside. But, man, it was dark in that barn. Man, I just saw things all over the place. You know, I was just throwing stuff around. I got out of the barn. I slammed the door behind me and bolted, and I'm standing like this, you know, just terrified. And I didn't know it, but the little neighbor girl that lived there was walking down the road, down the country road, coming to our place to play with my sister. And she saw me come out of that barn, white as a ghost, slam the door and stand like this. She says, "What's wrong?" Well, do you think I'm going to tell her the truth?
I'm scared of the dark.
No, you know, I mean, what will she think of me, you know? So what do? I said, "There's somebody in the barn." Yeah. She says, "Really?" She says, "Yeah. And he's big, and he's got a knife." She takes off running for the house, and I'm standing there and say, "What do I do now?" You know? So I try to catch up to her to kind of say, "Well, don't tell anybody." But she's ahead of me. She goes bursting into the house, my house, screaming. My mother's on the phone. She's calling the police, you know. What does an alcoholic do when he's caught in a lie? Okay? Man, you hang in there, you know. I mean, you just hang in there. The police go out there, guns drawn, lights all over the place, you know. And all they see are these little tiny fourth grader footprints all over the place in the snow. No big footprints, you know. And he said, "You saw this guy in a barn, huh?" "Yeah." "Oh, yeah. Can you describe it?" "Oh, it's big. Scars, you know, knife that long, you know." I mean, the more I told it, the worse it got. And the cops are going to sit there and winking at each other. Yeah, you know. So what happened is they kind of laughed it off, you know. Mom was trying to, "Jerry, are you sure?" "Oh, that's a terrible one," you know. And Dad came home, "Son, tell me about this," you know. "No, oh, that's terrible," you know. And I went on and on and on. Well, this little girl that was in my grade went back to school and blabbered to everybody, "Jerry's seeing things," you know, and the laugh, you know, and all that stuff. I got a resentment. You know, I never backed down from that. I never backed down from the story. And I got a resentment. She was ruining my life. It was her fault. I mean, if she hadn't been such a blabbermouth, it would have never happened. Man, I'm laying in the woods for her with stones inside of snowballs. I mean, I tortured that poor girl until eighth grade for 4 more years, you know, because I had this resentment. I wouldn't let it go, right? You know, years later, years later, at the ripe old age of about 44, I was about 8 years old when that happened. At 44 years old, when I was doing the ninth step, you know what I did? I told my father the truth. Now, he didn't even remember what the hell it was about. You know, I mean, here's this big deal I'm carrying my whole life. You know, what will he think of me if he finds out? You know, and it's kind of eating its way out of me, you know. And I'm stopping it back in here. Don't let anybody know, okay? And I finally said, "Dad, you know, here I am, 44 years old. My father comes down for good. "Dad, you know, about that time with the guy in the barn." "What?" You know, the guy in the barn, the big guy with a knife and the scars and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I think I remember. "Well, Dad, I was scared and I didn't really, there was nobody in the barn." You know, he says, "Oh, I knew that." I'm thinking, you know, years I'm going around beating myself up, carrying this thing around. But the thing is, all the characteristics that I had then are the same characteristics that I had as an alcoholic. What would I do to avoid embarrassment? What was I concerned about what people think of me? What would I do? I mean, you gotta lie when you're drinking, you know. I mean, you almost have to keep doing it. And when you come home and you've been gone, you know, you call up and say, "Honey, don't pay the ransom, I escaped." You finally come home, you know, 2 days later, you know, and she says, "Where the hell you been?" I mean, you don't tell the truth. "I don't know. You know, let me check my matchbook covers and see what they say." You know, you can't tell the truth because you wouldn't believe that either. So you gotta make something up, okay? All the characteristics that I had all through my drinking career were there as a kid in the fourth grade. It was all there. The resentment, the blaming somebody else for what I created, it was all there. Okay? And as we go through this thing, I'm probably not going to finish with step four today. I'll probably go in a little bit into step four next week and get into step five. And as you know, I don't really finish exactly one week and start exactly at another one or another step. But it was all there. What else did we talk about? We talked about fears. And it talks specifically about how to list these things. I love it when they do this. They say, what do? You list it. Resentment. Against who? What caused that?
Well, she told that, you know,
and that type of thing. What did it affect? Basically three things that the big book talks about. Sex, society, and security. What will people think of me? So I'm going to take away something I have, or I'm not going to get what I want, right? Three basic things. Okay. And it talks about instincts gone awry. You know, we all have these instincts. Ours kind of go wacko, okay? Right? I mean, when you think about what you wanted when you were drinking, everything and more of it, okay? I mean, all I really wanted was just to meet the blonde nymphomaniac millionaires who owned a chain of liquor stores, you know? But, I mean, not a whole lot, but, I mean, that type of thing. And it talks about what does it affect? You know, there, years and years and years after 1935, after they came up with the steps, I've studied a little bit of psychology and psychiatry, and they came up with a method of not treatment, but of counseling. It's called RET, Rational Emotive Therapy. And what it talks about is most people think that what happens is what causes their reaction to what happens. Ever notice that? You know, Jerry, why did you shoot the flare gun at those cars? Okay, all right. Those people were trying to mow me down when I was trying to cross Beach Boulevard. That's why. That's the answer I would have given. Is that the truth? No. They didn't know me from Adam. They're driving around and coming home at 3 a.m., right? Probably from a bar, you know. And here's this guy in dark clothing trying to cross the street with an arm full of booze, you know, stepping out in front of them, right? They didn't know who I was. But see, what happened was there was something that happened in between that activating event and my consequence, my emotional reaction to that, shooting flare guns at them, okay? It was my belief system. It's what I thought was happening, okay? And I never challenged what I thought was happening. I just believed that that's the way it was, okay? What do we do when we start putting this stuff down on paper? What happened? What caused it? What did it affect? And as I begin to list these things, I begin to say, gee, you know, there's some patterns here. What happened back in the fourth grade is the same kind of thing that happened later here and happened later down here and happened with my boss when he fired me over here. And what was I doing? I was believing that these people were causing my problems. And I began to look at the patterns of what was happening. And I began to look at, in a fifth step especially, with the help of another person, my belief system. What I thought was happening and what was really happening. Who caused my problems? I can look back on it now and say, Patty Witt didn't cause my problems. You know, she just happened to be the person that was there. And if it wasn't her and somebody else saw me, it would have been somebody else. Okay? And it wasn't her that caused that situation. It was me. I was the one that caused it. And as you begin to look at this, and you see, you ever see people at an AA dance once in a while? Ever see them come in drunk once in a while? I mean, watch two people dance and another couple dance. I've seen this happen, and I'm not going to say at an AA dance, but, you know, dance around, having fun, not paying a whole lot of attention. A guy bumps into another guy when they're dancing with their dates. Think of two possible reactions. One guy says, oh, excuse me, I'm sorry. Oh, okay, you know. Go along, all right? What's the belief system? That was an accident. Another guy says, come on, you know, I mean, yeah, totally different reaction, okay? You can tell that I've done that once in a while, all right? Totally different reaction, all right? Both of them will say, what caused this? They said, both of them would say, oh, we bumped into each other. But the belief system was different. The first one believed that it was an accident. The second believed, he's trying to show me up in front of my girl. I'll show him, okay? Or whatever was going on, okay? Or he did that on purpose. Or he's picking on me. The belief system was different. What was happening is my belief system was what was causing a lot of my reaction. And it's interesting that they came up with RET years and years and years after AA was doing it in these steps. When you stop to think about it. And we'll talk about that as we go on. What happens? We dispute the belief system, and then we change the consequence, and we change our belief system. Okay? And the part of that I like is the action steps of going through this. How do we do that? The only way I know to do that, this is not part of AA, but it's just so consistent with it, is to list it down. All right? Resentments. And what's behind a lot of resentments? Fear. And fear, I tell you what, fear can direct a person's life, and they never know it. Never know it. I felt like I was angry my whole life. Angry my whole life. But you know what anger is for the most part? It's a secondary reaction to fear. Think about this. You ever step out, you know, standing on a corner of walk and don't walk, right? Not paying a whole lot of attention, and you step out, and all of a sudden this car goes, and it stops about that far from you, right? What's your first reaction? Yeah. I mean, your heart's going blum, 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 and you leap 60 feet to the opposite curb. You didn't know you'd jump that far. First reaction is fear. What's your next reaction? You turn around, you're waving at the guy with all your fingers, and you're shouting things to him in foreign languages, and, you know, and then you go. I mean, it goes right back to the caveman days, you know? I mean, when the caveman encountered the saber-toothed tiger, he's going to do one of two things. He's going to run like the Dickens, first of all. If he can't, he's going to pick up a stone and get there and fight like the devil. Okay? And those guttural reactions to life are the same things that we do. Okay? Without the saber-toothed tiger, we react to life like we're being attacked all the time. And I lived in anger, and I never understood why I was so angry all the time. Until I began to list my fears. And when I address my fears, guess what happens to the anger? It's absolutely amazing how this thing works. Absolutely amazing. I'm running a little bit short on time. I know there's probably some chips to give away and all that good stuff. And I don't want to interfere with that. I think chips are wonderful. I love being a chipmunk. Chips are great. And I'm sorry I was holding on to my behind when I walked up here. I overheard Rick say he was going to grab my seat when I got up. I'll probably do a little bit more on step four next week. It leads very naturally into step five, and I'll probably do step six and seven in 1 week, so I don't have going to week 13 weeks, you know, we don't have a 13th step really in this program, and go from there. Thank you all, and love you.